Welcome to Blockchain Versus, a podcast specifically intended to dive deep into the technology that we call blockchain and how it has the massive potential to disrupt a number of different industries and literally change the face of how we do business every single day. We're also going to be bringing on some of the most influential people in the blockchain and cryptocurrency space to talk about projects that they're working on and how this technology truly has the opportunity to disrupt the world as we know it. This is Blockchain Versus. All right. Thank you, everybody, for joining us on another episode of Blockchain Versus. Today, we have a very special guest. And of course, you know, I'm always joined by Miss Christina Brujan. But the special guest is somebody that we've known for quite a while now, had conversations with about many different topics, including obviously blockchain and crypto, artificial intelligence, and how basically all this type of technology is going to change the world as we know it and how we do business. We're really excited to have Mr. Stephen Naroff on the podcast today. Stephen, how are you doing?
Hey, Jeremy. I'm doing great. I'm looking forward to talking to you.
Absolutely. Well, Stephen, there's a lot of people out there that already know who you are, you know, in the blockchain space. But for those people that don't know who you are, let's start from the beginning, because, you know, Christina and I obviously know about, you know, some of the things that you've done and how influential you've been to the evolution of blockchain in the space. So can you help people to understand exactly how you got in and really some of the things that you're working on very early on to help shape the future of where we're at today?
Yeah, sure. So my journey in blockchain is a really interesting one. I came into blockchain around 2011 when somebody introduced me to Bitcoin. I spent, you know, the past 20 plus years building tech companies in New York and Silicon Valley, plus being a VC. So I kind of came into that mindset, was super enthralled with Bitcoin. So to me, it looked like the new monetary system. And then late 2013, somebody showed me the Ethereum white paper. Shortly thereafter, I ended up getting involved. And my job over there was to figure out how to do a crowd sale in a legal manner. And the model that I invented over there ended up getting copied and pasted a couple thousand times and turned into, that was effectively the ICO.
Right.
And I worked with, you know, dozens of projects after that. And then in 2017, I kind of saw some of the abuses that were happening and got involved in the security token side of things. And then I structured T0's security token offerings, kind of like a seminal offering in the space. And so I got very involved in security token offerings. So there's kind of like this, you know, the split between the two.
Yep. No, that's really cool. So, I mean, for those folks out there that don't know Stephen, he's, you know, been there since very early on, really helping Ethereum from a legal standpoint and formulate the ICO. So this is a pretty incredible person and wealth of knowledge in the industry. You know, obviously you mentioned T0, but there's a number of different projects that you're working with, you know, whether it's Ethereum, Casper Labs, T0, Lisk, Aon. And I know that Adaptive Holdings is something that it seems somewhat new in terms of what you're doing there. So maybe talk a little bit about some of the projects that you're working with and how you're helping them and maybe what excites you most about them.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, right now my attention is very focused on Casper Labs. I'm the chairman and co-founder of the company, and that is Vlad Zamfir's leading Ethereum researcher, originally designed the Casper protocols as a scaling solution for Ethereum. For a whole host of reasons, Ethereum is not able to implement that right now. And we reconnected, Vlad and I and some other folks, after, you know, working together a number of years back, to actually build a native chain from scratch. And what's super exciting about this one is this is the first time I saw a blockchain that actually really solved the trilemma. And the trilemma is the three legs of a blockchain: so scalability, security, and decentralization. And pretty much every blockchain has had success in solving two of the three. So you've got Ethereum and Bitcoin. They solve, they're certainly decentralized, and they're secure, but they don't scale. And that's what that's caused is a lot of proof of concepts and really interesting ideas and getting people excited, but it hasn't allowed blockchain to really proliferate, the killer dApps to emerge, those kinds of things. On the other hand, you have a whole host of blockchains that have high transactions per second and seem very impressive. So what they've solved is scalability, and oftentimes they're secure, sometimes not. But what they did do is they did it at the expense of decentralization. And what that means is that there's some element in those blockchains that are centralized, basically. And so examples of that would be you'd have delegates. And so maybe like 20 or 30 delegates more or less verify transactions and come, you know, deal with the consensus of the protocol. The issue there is you could potentially have collusion, and it's not censorship resistant. So you don't have the things that made Ethereum and Bitcoin, you know, proliferate in terms of people feeling comfortable in using them. So what Vlad invented was the first one that actually solves all three of those. And to me, this is one of the things that's been holding blockchain back, is you have these dApps that are being built, and either because they don't, you know, let's say they're on one something that is decentralized, but it doesn't scale, it basically becomes proof of concepts. On the ones that do scale, but there's a chance of collusion, you're getting very low value dApps. So you're not getting, you know, this is the internet of value. This is Web 3.0. There's going to be trillions of dollars of value going on to these chains. And frankly, there's people, you know, risk management departments are not going to allow, you know, let's say Wall Street 2.0, which we think is going to be, you know, under blockchain is going to be underneath that whole movement. Well, it's not going to be under one that there's any chance of collusion. So we're going to be launching that later this year. We're pretty excited about it. We're focusing a lot of effort there.
That's really cool. No, I've just, definitely been following Casper Labs. I mean, it's very interesting. And I agree that there's a lot of problems to be solved in the industry. Obviously, you know, no technology is perfect. We're still early on. So there's still a lot that we need to work through to make this something that is ready for mass adoption. Totally understand. One of the things I want to ask you too, I mean, look, you've been in the space for quite a while. You've seen the ups and downs, you know, regardless of price, but, you know, in terms of people's openness to looking into this type of technology to, you know, serve as maybe the basis of their infrastructure, you know, whether it be supply chain management, capital markets, like you were talking about. I mean, can you talk about what you've seen over these last 4 or 5 years as this, you know, entire industry is just really evolving? I mean, people have really changed their tune, I would say, over the last 8, 9, 12 months in terms of especially like mass market. That's one thing, and they haven't really necessarily come back in, as we've seen with this new price movement. It seems to be more the institutions and the Fortune 500s and 100s that really understand it, and it's kind of a race of arms right now to be able to load up and to be able to get people that understand the technology on their board so they can start adopting it in a way that makes sense so they don't get left behind.
Yeah, it's been really interesting how it's developed. By way of my background, I was in the heart of Silicon Valley running internet companies during the internet boom. And I had the distinct pleasure of being there for the bust. Of course, in hindsight, it wasn't really a bust. It was just a little blip. But I stayed there and I'm now dubbing that internet winter after our crypto winter, but that was far worse than what we just experienced. I remember my drive from San Jose up to San Francisco got cut by 30 minutes within about a 7 or 8 month period when so many people left, and the way I say the visitors went home. But the guys who really believed in the internet stayed. And the difference kind of there was you had an underlying protocol, the TCP/IP, and going back to the 60s with the ARPANET. And so there was countries and universities and industry collaborating, agreeing, and building something out, and then finally saying, here's the standard. And so then the commercial internet was born when Netscape came out. And now all of a sudden we could see pictures and it was pretty, and then people got excited. Of course, the World Wide Web was there already, but that was the launch. But they had this already infrastructure in place, be it good or bad. The blockchain is really different. So blockchain, you've got no agreement on the standard. The tech, you know, isn't quite there yet for commercial readiness. And I believe it's a technology that's going to be far more disruptive than the internet was, you know, in the order of magnitude. So it's going to require quite a bit of industrial strength to be able to, you know, hit all the use cases. What is interesting is that I don't think there's probably a Fortune 500 company that doesn't have people thinking about their blockchain strategy. They've, you know, spent the last few years tinkering with proof of concepts here, getting familiar with the technology. But blockchain is one of those things that until you immerse yourself in it, and a lot of us in the industry like to say they fell down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. And you know, the more you get interested, you know, the more interested you get. You know, and then like the more you learn, the more you realize how little you actually understand this and the farther reaching implications of this are. I think that's happening to these entities. So they went with very basic use cases, tried proof of concept, but really what they were doing was using the basic internet model and using it in a decentralized way, but they weren't really using the power of decentralization the way it could be used. So, you know, this is a new way of thinking. There are new models that need to come out of this. Just like the internet brought new models that you didn't just take your brick and mortar models, they got changed. Right. And so that I think you're starting to see that slowly emerge. At the same time, you're seeing them, you know, I'm using the big corporations because, you know, a lot of the disruption, people think they're all going to get disrupted. No, actually, they're going to do a lot of the disruption themselves. And I think that's a good thing. But there's also, you know, new massive companies that will be bigger than Google and Facebook and Apple or any of them are today. I firmly believe that this industry is have a very high probability of producing the world's first trillionaire. The amount of wealth that's going to get created out of this will probably be an order of magnitude more. And hell, Jeff Bezos is worth 100 something billion, so why not a trillion for somebody in this space? So I think that, you know, the specific sectors, the verticals that you're talking about, the issues are somewhat technology, but there's also, you know, getting consensus around like supply chain management. You know, a lot of these things, you know, we're talking about networks, you know, all of these in blockchain, they're all networks. You're participating in some kind of network. So it by definition requires, coming together of many parties, you know, at some points, you know, billions and maybe multiple billions. Right. So it's that's thinking about how to, you know, and change practices to get people to come onto the blockchain, you know, it's just starting to happen. We're really in the early stages of that. I think now at this point, it's beyond the point where it's not going to happen. I think it's a foregone conclusion that blockchain is going to disrupt most industries. There's serious efforts going on, but it took a few years for them to kind of play with the technology because, frankly, the internet was complicated to people back then. Now, in hindsight, it doesn't seem so complicated. But blockchain actually is relatively complicated. You know, the internet wasn't as complicated.
Yeah, I totally agree. And obviously, you know, we have the podcast Blockchain Versus. We think it'll disrupt a whole lot of pretty much everything as well. But there's a timeline to it, right? There's like this Darwinian landscape that tends to evolve. And I completely agree with you. If you look at the market cyclical nature of, from the inception of the stock market, you look back, you know, at the big companies 50 years ago, 20 years ago, and now, I mean, the nature was it was really big banks and then it was really big tech companies and the tech companies are just massive in percentage comparison to everything else out there. And we're just getting started. We're in the infancy. So Stephen, I always have many questions for you, but we kind of started down this lane of, you know, Fortune 500 adopting things and needing to kind of create the infrastructure there. There's a lot of interesting things that are happening around the globe to create infrastructure that I know that you're involved in. I know you've been asked to participate in some, government meetings and how they will adopt a blockchain strategy or how some of the islands are adopting like the blockchain tax safe havens, kind of becoming the new Grand Caymans of blockchain. And I love that the islands are fighting back. I mean, it's difficult to create revenue outside of tourism. So anything to, you know, help them fight back is makes me happy. But that's a climate change conversation we won't get into right now. But I know you've been asked to participate in several of those things. Do you mind kind of giving a little overview about what that landscape looks like?
Yeah, sure. So there's various different camps. The geography thing is kind of driven by Western world, not only Western world, but first world, I would say, regulations on the larger countries, the U.S. being the primary culprit there. But Europe is not necessarily that far behind, and China, you know, certainly has its say in shaping how things happen. And what's happening is that those jurisdictions have not yet gotten comfortable with blockchain, cryptocurrency, Bitcoin. They're not even really sure what the distinctions between those words mean. They're not really sure how this is disrupting them. You know, they probably are on Twitter and hearing, you know, hundreds of thousands of people saying, you know, we're going to replace the dollar, we're going to replace the euro, we're going to replace the government. It's probably not making them feel warm and fuzzy inside, right? So they're battening down the hatches in overkill in many ways and crudely, and cutting off innovation in a lot of ways. I think that will play itself out over time. They'll get more comfortable. They'll have regulations in place to still protect whatever it is that they want to protect. And the cat's out of the bag. So decentralization is going to happen, kind of a matter of time and how it happens. These islands are just like amazing, right? I mean, they need to innovate, because if they don't innovate, they die. They don't have other revenue sources. You know, the shining example is not necessarily a regulation, but an enactment of a law is at the Marshall Islands. Look at what they're doing. You know, they're looking to issue their entire monetary supply on their own blockchain and have it decentralized. And they would get a certain portion of the money supply. It has a fixed inflation rate, and that's the end of it. You know, that's pretty far reaching, right? But it is a member of the UN. It's a sovereign nation. But they're losing a big chunk, or like 40% of their budget right now is aid from the US. That's going away in a few years. And so they need to replace that. So, you know, these smaller places, you get Malta, who's done a lot of innovation in there, and yet part of the EC, the EU rather, not the, you know, the core guys, but the second tier guys, and still it's an EU country. So you're seeing a lot of those guys, and what's happening is that the innovation and the entrepreneurs are flocking to those places. You know, Singapore is another example. Cayman Islands is another example. The list kind of goes on, and those areas are starting to get a disproportionate share of the entrepreneurs. And it's interesting, because this is the first revolution in technology that I've seen that is not that does not start and end in, you know, off of Sand Hill Road in Silicon Valley. And so it's always right. This, you know,
it's got global 30
minutes, 40 minutes. Well, it's Silicon Valley, you know, stuttered on this one. They didn't, you know, they weren't on the lead by any stretch. They're still not in the lead. And so the innovations, and plus some of the financial centers, New York, Hong Kong, were, since the early use cases tended to be very fintech-oriented in blockchain and cryptocurrency, those places had a lot of bright ideas and folks that were seeped in, you know, fintech. And so you're starting to see, like, you know, in New York, there's a renaissance going on in fintech because of blockchain. I went to a fintech accelerator, and over half the companies were actually blockchain companies. So fintech is kind of like going blockchain, and it just makes a lot of sense. So you're starting to see these interesting things happening, but the diversity of where it's coming from is just unusual. Where, you know, you said Apple, Google, and Facebook are all within 20 minutes of each other, you know, three massive, massive companies, and not like Amazon and Microsoft are all that far away in Washington. It's, you know, all Northwest U.S., but now you're seeing, and Asia is really interesting. I mean, the two surprises that I would say, Asia, not necessarily surprised, but it's interesting how quickly they jumped onto the technology itself. I mean, even China, which is so far against cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin and all this other stuff, they're pushing the envelope in terms of blockchain innovation within government.
Right.
So those are what you were asking about earlier.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And I just completely agree with the fintech stuff. But that is something to explore here, is that the cryptocurrency industry and the fintech piece of it is a completely different animal than just the blockchain itself. And you were kind of touching on this with your Fortune 500 needing to adopt it. It's the same thing as you cannot keep a brick and mortar strategy anymore. You will need to adopt this. If you're not already innovating, you are already behind the curve. I think that one of the most interesting conversations you and I ever had was around AI and smart cities, and kind of how that can be just exponentially applied to a blockchain interoperability if we were to actually create that level of, you know, being able to move the data around the world that quickly. You would get real-time metrics from, I mean, just looking at it from supply chain and AI and like reducing, you know, the necessary FTEs within an organization, it's going to be imperative that they at least investigate into that. Can you tell us a little bit about your thoughts around AI and blockchain combo?
Yeah, so AI is certainly my passion. I was very happily running my AI company that I founded back in 2011 when I saw Bitcoin, and now I had two loves of my life. And the AI, I'm actually the author of like over 24 patents in AI, primarily machine vision. And like the company that I started, we in the area of smart cities, and we track objects in the city and make sure, you know, the city is able to then detect various objects and automate functionality within the city. And so think autonomous vehicles that are coming and traffic flow and mobility, and it's a pretty far-reaching area. And one of the things that we experienced was the blockchain was key to actually unlocking all of this. So the conversion of technologies that you're seeing is smart cities combined with artificial intelligence, combined with the Internet of Things, IoT. That intersection of those three things is kind of the sweet spot that's going to be explosive. They have a bottleneck. There's multiple bottlenecks that they have. Some are literal bottlenecks in terms of information can't flow easily enough, quickly enough, cheap enough, you know, for IoT devices. And cryptocurrency and crypto itself is like the perfect panacea for that. There's other stuff where you have regulatory and societal concerns, like privacy concerns. Well, all of that can, you know, you can have data, you know, that's only hashed, but that you only can see. You can have your private keys. The blockchain solves many of those problems as well. So what I'm seeing with blockchain is, it's not only going to disrupt all these other industries, blockchain becomes the key that unlocks the potential of multiple other explosive technologies. And we've never really seen a technology that does it to this level. I would say AI does do that somewhat, but it really unlocks, AI unlocks the potential more than anything of data. That was the explosiveness of AI. But blockchain unlocks the potential of AI. Blockchain unlocks the potential of smart cities, of Internet of Things. It's probably going to be the underlying basis, the plumbing, so to speak, for both IoT and smart cities, two, you know, enormous areas. Because when you look at the population trends, you know, by 2050, there's an astronomical percentage of people are going to be living in big cities. And the cities are simply just not equipped. They weren't built for this many people. They need to become automated. Blockchain is the one that's going to probably unlock a lot of that potential.
Yep. No, I totally agree. You and I have had many conversations around the intersection between AI and blockchain and what those implications can be, right? So when you talk about things like smart cities that you've been working on for quite a while, and obviously have a lot of, you know, intellectual property around that, et cetera, I mean, how close do you think we are? And is it going to be US? I mean, I personally don't think so. It's probably going to be overseas and, you know, some of the Asian countries, but we're seeing them adopt, you know, different types of technologies to where they're not necessarily even using cash anymore. It's all digital payments. They've already adopted it. So, I mean, how do you see that playing out, and how quickly do you think we can actually get to some sort of government running on a smart city infrastructure powered by AI and blockchain?
Yeah, so you're seeing it's a combination. Some countries, by their, you know, their way of being, so to speak, are more inclined to explore ways to automate cities, reduce hazardous materials, reduce the congestion, make life better. So there's a number of, in particular, let's say the Scandinavian countries, you know, their philosophy lends itself really well to smart cities. And the propensity for that is actually showing up in reality. So some of the most cutting edge technology in smart cities are coming out of those countries. On the other hand, there's also ones that just have the need. And so you're starting to see some countries that are way behind the curve in every other way, but kind of they just skipped over everything the Western world had, kind of like when cell phones came out, they never had landlines. So everybody has a cell phone before, you know, in some African countries before they had them in first world countries. And you're starting to see some of that now coming out here where, you know, they have this congestion and everything, and the technology has now become relatively inexpensive enough that it can be justified at many different levels. And you're starting to see that come out. You know, our company, it's called Cloud Park, and they have, we have multiple pilots going on in the United States. We weren't really sure how receptive that market would be, but it turns out it's pretty receptive. But it's not something I would say is a nationwide thing. It's more, there are cities, large cities, but there are cities that are very advanced, and you know, the citizens of those cities, you know, think a lot more forward thinking than other ones. And plus, the population trends they are looking and seeing is going to affect them a lot more than some other cities. Other cities are losing population over the next 20, 30 years. So they're preparing for that. But the things that these technologies do are just really amazing. You know, and it being unlocked by it, by blockchain, is really the amazing part of watching this. You know, seeing things like a municipal blockchain coming up where all the citizens are on that blockchain. You know, up until now, we've talked about all these use cases, but they haven't really categorized, like, you know, how are they going to organize these? But a government oriented for the citizens of that city is one logical taxonomy. You know, it may not be a long term one within a nation state, and that's a whole other conversation. But for now, you know, if everybody in New York or Beijing, you know, was on there, there's a lot of things that can be done that just could not have been done any other way, nor would people have necessarily trusted being on there.
Man, well, Stephen, I mean, you've obviously always been at the cutting edge of technology, whether it's blockchain or AI or anything else like that. And obviously you come from a background of, you know, investing in organizations, consulting with organizations. I mean, it's crazy when you look at your LinkedIn. I mean, you have your hand in everything. You have like 40 titles and they're all current. Like, I don't even know how you manage this stuff, right? but it's cool to see, because I mean, you really are somebody who's a wealth of knowledge. I mean, it's pretty incredible, and most people probably don't even know this, but the reason I met Stephen was very interesting, and this is really a testament to how incredibly approachable people are in the blockchain space, and how it's very different than that of typical Silicon Valley and tech companies, where everything's kind of standoffish and people like to big time you, right? To where I was looking for a domain name, specifically for my company in the blockchain space. And I didn't really know anything about blockchain. I didn't know the key players at that time. And I wanted to find who owned this particular domain. So I looked up the Whois records and I found, of course, it said your name, Stephen Naroff. I didn't know who you were at the time. So I decided to do a little detective work and went on your LinkedIn to see who you were, to see if I can contact you directly to be able to get this domain I really wanted. And I couldn't even believe it. I mean, it was just littered with all the stuff about, you know, how you were one of the creators of the ICO and how you're in security tokens. I'm like, oh my God, this is like the guy I want to talk to if I'm starting, you know, a company in this space. And I reached out to you and you were so accommodating, and you reached back out, you know, within, I think, 10 minutes and said, how can I help you? I'd love to help in some way. And then you and I just started having conversations about everything that we're doing in, you know, the intersection of capital markets and blockchain and AI. You know, and then I know Christina met you out at Consensus, and you guys had a good conversation there as well. So it's one of those things to where, you know, I love this space because, like I said, people are accessible in a different way than any other industry that I've ever seen in my life. People want this to happen. It's like we're all on the same team and we're all fighting for the same thing, for this to ultimately succeed as an industry. So, I mean, would you agree that it's just a very different feeling than any other industry that you've been a part of as well?
Yeah, completely. Thank you for the kind words. I mean, it's this space. When I came into this, I can't imagine there was more than a few thousand people, you know, in the whole world. I think I went to the New York Bitcoin meetup. It was probably 2012 when I first went there. And there was about 20 people who showed up, and they claimed it to be the largest in the world, right? And so that tells you, you know, how few people were involved. And kind of, you know, it's, there's some feelings of that still around where, you know, even though now there's millions of people that are in crypto in one way or another, it still feels small and it still feels accessible. And people are, you know, you see forums like Twitter in particular, where people are debating issues and really discussing things out in the open. We also never had a technology come out that's as broad and expansive and disruptive as blockchain is when you have things like social media and we're connected in ways that we've never been connected before. So you're starting to see some phenomenons. So like, how does this happen? How can a group come together and form some kind of consensus, no pun intended, over specific issues? And you're starting to see in blockchain, they're actually doing that. Now, there's a lot of rough fighting that happens to get to that point, but the fact that you're starting to see that they're, you know, and then once there's some consensus reached, it's kind of like a lot of people push in that direction. But at the same time, you know, one thing I would say is that the disruptive nature of this space, you know, is what's discussed a lot. But the fact is, it's so not zero-sum game. It's like it's such an expansive, abundant technology. I've never really quite seen anything like this that is going to create not just wealth, but is going to create like abundance in efficiencies and potentially, you know, literally resolving. You know, there was a great study I saw that, you know, thought blockchain actually had the potential to wipe out hunger, you know, in countries, you know, within a generation. So these are like life altering things. It's you know, we had a company. We run an accelerator with there's a company called TechStars, the leading accelerator company in the world. And we had this company in there called Emblema. And they they basically connect patients with drug companies for clinical trials. And often they tend to be stage four type of, you know, it's the most dire cases. And the patients don't often know about the clinical trials. And these are real strong domain experts in healthcare, super bright guys. We're building this out. They have relationships with the drug companies and that are holding the clinical trials. And they were, you know, allowing people to sign up and find out about it. And they discovered decentralization and they turned themselves into a blockchain company. And it's a perfect use case for it. Now people can upload their medical data. It's a open system where anybody can access it. It's the potential that's there is like, I am totally convinced that this one company is just one example is going to save untold number of lives, that people are going to access care that they couldn't have accessed otherwise. And them just having that on a database would not have had the same effect of the way I believe it's going to, you know, proliferate the way we've seen open source projects proliferate, that, you know, much quicker than non-open source. I mean, there are some examples of non-open source that have proliferated, but the open source stuff where everybody feels a part of it, they have more control, they have control over their own data, and particularly healthcare. Everybody's been trying to get healthcare on the blockchain for many years now. They've been talking about it, but nobody's really made a dent in it. Well, here's a really cool use case that not only saves lives, but actually could potentially unify data over time.
I love that so much. I'm over here on mute, just like smiling, because I agree. It's one of those perfect use cases. And I see more and more of those come out. I mean, I've been in the space now for the better part of 2 years. And, you know, when we met at Consensus last year, you know, Jeremy sent me out there and he's like, it's Mother's Day. You want to go? And I'm like, heck yeah. But there was like 12,000 people or 16,000 people. I heard crazy, crazy, crazy numbers. And then you look at where we ran into you in January after Crypto Winter at one of the biggest Bitcoin conferences down in Miami. And like, you know, everyone was like, it was easier to get access to everybody. But point being, it's been a bit of a roller coaster, and those real blockchain scenarios, those real great use cases are starting to come out. And I have to be honest, I probably name drop you a disgusting amount of times, pretty much any time that security tokens come up. I'm like, oh yeah, do you know Steven Nero? Because like he knows everything to do with all of that. But some of those really great use cases, you know, were ICOs and then and STOs, there's an evolution piece there. And you're so saturated in tokens and the tokenization of all things, of all assets, and kind of how this new evolution is happening. Can you touch a little bit around kind of just your security token background? I'm sure that's, you know, we've got time. The next 8 days, just keep talking.
Yeah, so this, for the first number of years, particularly this mantra started with Ethereum in 2014. You saw t-shirts with people saying decentralize everything. And I think starting in 2017, 2018, the mantra would have been tokenize everything. And it's, you know, somebody that looks at this technology, you know, you're the hammer and every asset that you can possibly think of and somebody you wouldn't have never thought of starts to look like a nail. And you want to use this technology to tokenize these things. And the amount of assets in this world that are not liquid is far greater than the ones that are liquid. Even the ones that are liquid, you know, in the traditional digital security sense, as opposed to cryptographic securities, they simply isn't or it's the advancement of what that does is tremendous. So, you know, simple cases, and I say simple because it's not that it's really simple to execute upon it, but it's simple to understand, is things like real estate. You know, it's a quadrillion, let's look that up on Google. That's 1,000 trillion. So $250 trillion in physical real estate that can be tokenized. And now all of a sudden that capital, like people don't even think about what are the implications of that? Well, it's not just the building owner, you know, all of a sudden gets liquidity. It's that all of a sudden you've got $250 trillion of trapped liquidity that now can flow into the global economy and be put to other productive uses. So these are big things without and a very much of a blockchain way of thinking without having to print more fiat money. You know, you're just unlocking the assets that have been locked for so long. And that is going to rush, you know, new capital in, and governments don't have to actually print money to, you know, fund, you know, for people to, you know, inflate their way to hell and have some money to invest in maybe productive goods, but who knows?
Steven, real quick, I need to interject with a question because, you know, you hear a lot of these podcasts and we're talking at a certain level, but, you know, every once in a while, my friends come up to me, right? And they ask me like more basic questions and you forget that the masses obviously don't understand, you know, the technology underpinnings of some of this stuff and how it actually works. So if you were to just like sum it up in terms of the real estate example, how would you describe to somebody so they could really wrap their heads around how are we really accessing capital or liquidity that didn't exist? Like what, how does it actually work? Try to dumb it down for a sec.
Yeah. So, I mean, a real basic level, what you're doing is you're saying this building has a certain value. Now this is get way more complicated than this, but you're these things that we have tokens, which all reside on a blockchain. You can put the value of you can have a token represent the value of an asset. And so I can say, you know, it's more or less arbitrary or how you design it at first. There are some considerations, but you can say, you know, this building is worth, you know, $1 million, let's say US or whatever it is in euro, or and you can say, oh, now instead of dollars, it's going to represent in tokens. And the owner of the deed holder of that building is going to have an address, which is what we use on the blockchain, that's going to contain these million tokens. And he holding it. So this is another thing that's pretty amazing. He's holding that asset, assuming he doesn't have a mortgage or anything, he owns the building outright. He's holding his asset in a form that's not physical, cryptographic, or digital, right? So he's holding it in his own wallet that he's the only person who has access. When does that happen? Like other than cash, and even cash is not really, I mean, but it's assets that are in digital form called stocks, bonds, you know, anything that's representing ownership in a company, you know, they're the ownership interest generally being held somewhere else. And so it's not, you know, and even if it is, it's custody and other kinds of requirements. So it's not this peer-to-peer kind of system where you can actually have sole custody of your own asset. So in the building example, you'd have a million-dollar building. The million-dollar building can be converted into a million tokens. And now the holders of those tokens have whatever rights you've decided to assign to those tokens, and the value of the building that you've decided to assign to that, and somebody has to buy it. You know, somebody has to agree that it's worth that. But now the transferability, you know, now you could literally, if I can remember my private key, you know, the value of my building travels with me in my head, or in a piece of paper that's locked somewhere, and that'll get more sophisticated. But that's kind of it at a base level. Now the ability for that to move is super interesting. And so I want to sell my building. You know, could I just transfer this economic interest of the building, the $1 million of value of the building that's captured in my tokens? Can I just transfer somebody those tokens? And the answer is probably yes. Now, there's all kinds of old regulations that, you know, it's so much of a round peg square hole that do not fit this whole new paradigm. You know, so under the old paradigm, so the regulations still have to catch up. But theoretically, that if once, you know, in some situations, you know, once they get caught up and they get adapted to this, and I believe that they will, you know, I could in literally, if, you know, anywhere from a few seconds to a few minutes, I could transfer, you know, 10% of those tokens to somebody else, and he could send Bitcoin to me for whatever amount, and I'm going to sell this to you for 100 Bitcoin, and he sends a Bitcoin to me, and I just sold 10% of my building. I didn't go through lawyers. I didn't, you know, sit around for a month negotiating and having to work through and get deeds transferred and all these other things. I just sent the economic interest of this asset to this person. Now, like I said, the regulations have to still catch up and get more adapted to this. But then that's simple enough. But then things like smart contracts come into play. And that's where it starts to get a lot more interesting. And smart contracts are more or less if then statements, either the programs, and there's this intelligence that you can program into the blockchain now. So the blockchain without a smart contract is just a ledger with numbers that everybody agrees that these numbers are what we all agreed to, and we form a consensus, and everybody trusts that consensus. But smart contracts, with Vitalik pioneered in the blockchain space with Ethereum, you know, all of a sudden adds intelligence to that. And now you can have a smart contract that says these token holders of that building for $1 million with a million tokens, and now I just transferred 100,000 of those tokens. You know, Alice sold them to Bob, and now Bob's holding them. But the smart contract knows that it's paying the rent or the whatever, you know, you've agreed through this smart contract. As that money comes in, then the token holders, where, you know, where the tokens are designated, you know, that flows right to them. It's really automating all these processes, right, and allowing for easy transferability. And I can send, one of the things that the ICO boom in 2017, 2018 really kind of highlighted that was so astounding is that crypto has this ability that we've never seen anything else do, that you can transfer value to the tunes of hundreds of millions of dollars in instant from millions of people all around the world where that capital wants to go. You know, I mean, without talking about the pros and cons of the specifics of the ICO, it's just that one concept was, I think, earth-shattering to a lot of people. And that's where you're starting to see things like JP Morgan Coin and all these other projects starting to come out, even Libra by Facebook, where they're seeing, you know, it showed the power of cryptocurrency at a very small level. It wasn't that big on the, you know, relative to the global economy. It wasn't even a rounding error.
Just to interrupt really quick, sorry, because you touched on a whole bunch of things that make me really excited about the entire concept of security tokens. And it did start on the ICO and it did show all those patterns. One of those things you mentioned about regulation, for me, that I get excited in tokenization is it lowers the barrier to entry, where you don't have to be a rich person to be able to invest. You don't have to own an entire building to be able to be in the real estate game. There's all kinds of opportunities that happen from tokenizing and, you know, getting rewards in tokenized economies that had never, ever existed before. So I think that's one of those things that maybe if people don't understand understand about tokenization and STOs and this evolution of what's happening is that, yes, part of it is to break it into these pieces, but part of that is to lower the barrier to entry so more people can have access to those pieces, and it creates more global economy liquidity. So just piggybacking off of all of that, but I get so excited that this even exists, right? I mean, it's just, but it's such a big concept for some people to wrap their heads around.
Yeah, there's certain aspects to it that are, you know, so part of the ethos of tokens and crypto that, you know, it bumps up against the way the world works today. Like securities in general, you know, in most jurisdictions, there's requirements depending on the type of securities that are being offered. You know, for example, in the U.S., there's accredited, you know, investor standards. And so they're so high of a bar, a very small percentage of the population actually, you know, meets that standard. And then here comes crypto, where it can kind of flow freely. You kind of have to balance those two. And so the world's still figuring that out. We haven't gotten there yet. But the fact that crypto flows so freely and it goes to the two, you know, the lowest person, earning person in society can still contribute, you know, a dollar if they want to a project, you know, to whatever they want. The cost of executing on that transaction is so low and there's so few frictions on it, they can do that. But to be fair, they still need to figure this out. And so the concept that you're talking about being more inclusive is absolutely part of the core of crypto, and that's battling.
Well, cool. Well, I know we're limited on time here. Stephen, this has been super interesting. Let's go ahead and move on to one of the final phases of this interview, which is our favorite part, the lightning round. So I'm going to ask you a number of questions. Just give me your quick answer, whatever comes to your mind first, just so we can kind of see the lay of the land and what you're thinking about a lot of you know, specific topics in the space.
Sounds great.
There we go. Oh, cool. All right. So do you think Bitcoin has the opportunity to become the global reserve currency?
Yes, it has the opportunity. Absolutely.
Do you think companies like JP Morgan? Oh, okay. You had more.
Yeah, I just think it has the opportunity. I actually personally don't think it's necessarily going to be the global reserve currency. I think it, if it can get to 20 trillion, you know, I think it becomes an alternative competing currency. And I think that's fine. It solves its purpose. You know, it keeps the other currencies in check now. And that's why it just has to get a lot bigger to get there.
Yep. Okay, cool. Do you think companies like JP Morgan and Facebook coming into the space are good or bad for the industry?
There's pros and cons. Overall, it's a massive positive. Facebook more so, because if they execute on their plans, just exposing, you know, a third of the world's population to what crypto works and having some kind of crypto, even if we don't really think it's the real crypto, but it kind of feels like it. And I go back to AOL. AOL wasn't the internet, but it kind of sort of felt like the internet, and people thought they were on the internet. Eventually, they got comfortable with AOL and they actually went on the real internet. Probably what's going to happen there. And, you know, they'll adapt and see how much works for them long term.
Yep. All right. Libra. Facebook's cryptocurrency that they're releasing. Is it going to succeed or fail?
Limited success, because I don't think the central banks are just going to, there's no way they're giving carte blanche to Facebook to just go ahead and compete with 2.5 billion people in its ranks. So that's the big point, is the central banks and how they come after Facebook. So I think it'll be limited success, but their blockchain may be more successful because they're using that for things like privacy and other things. So it's a multi-pronged answer.
Yep. No, I agree. All right, cool. Is Bitcoin ultimately a store of value or a peer-to-peer payment system when it all plays out?
Oh, so it's both. I mean, right now it's neither store of value nor is it a currency, because it's too small and too volatile to serve either purpose. But once it levels off and gets really big, I think it becomes both of those. And that's actually when it becomes a peer-to-peer payment system. Even though technically you can do it right now, nobody really wants to spend Bitcoin. It's too complicated, and people who are buying it are hodling and thinking it's going up a lot, so people don't really want to spend it. I think we're probably maybe... we're a number of years away from that happening. If it's 5 to 15, I don't know, but it's a number of years away.
Okay, good answer. What would you say is blockchain's biggest weakness right now?
Blockchain's biggest weakness? the I would say it's a PR firm, you know, the PR firm that Bitcoin hired, that the CEO of Bitcoin hired, they should fire that firm. Being facetious, yeah. but it's funny, actually, somebody asked recently, I was on a thread, and somebody said, who's the CEO of Bitcoin? And we were all like, whoa, you know, the hand and face emoji. But right now, I talk to very knowledgeable people, and they genuinely say, you know, Bitcoin's only used by drug dealers and, you know, illicit things and dual money launderers. So we need adoption. The tech will come. The tech will get there. I'm seeing that. So it's just going to take a little bit of time. But the adoption thing, we need to work to educate people why cryptocurrencies are a positive thing for society and why they're not necessarily going to replace, you know, and disrupt everybody. You know, they're actually going to enhance people's lives.
All right. So two more questions here. So if there's one crypto that will eventually take over Bitcoin or have the opportunity to take over Bitcoin as the leader, which one has the highest likelihood of doing so, would you say?
That's a good question because I don't know one that I think has the ability to take over Bitcoin. I'm not sure that I have an answer for you on that one. Bitcoin's got a network effect. Bitcoin has a network effect already kicked in. It's valuable because everybody uses it and everybody is comfortable with it. It's got the brand effect kicked in. What it doesn't have, it's not scalable. And people are underappreciating the importance of that. It's just not scalable. So I'm not saying it's impossible for something to come out. I don't see anything on the landscape that could eventually challenge it for dominance, but it does have enough weaknesses that somebody could create, or a creation could come out of a new protocol that could potentially challenge it.
I like that. That was a good safe answer, but I actually happen to agree. If somebody would have asked me that, I would have said pretty much the same thing. So last question here. So I know a lot of people, especially listeners, want to hear, of course, always about the price and price predictions. You know, you have people that say $0 all the way to $1 million. I'm not going to necessarily hold you to anything, but one thing that we like to do is play a game of over under. So we're going to do at the end of this year, 2019, and then we're going to also do one for 5 years. So for the end of this year, December 31st, 2019, over or under Bitcoin at 20K?
Over.
Okay. 5 years from today, over or under 1 million?
Ooh, 5 years and 1 million. So it's a 50x increase. I'm probably going to say under on that one within 5 years. I think it may take a little bit longer. And if it happens too quickly, I'd have to ask what the hell happened in society that caused it to go that rapid and that vertical and blow up like that. And it's probably not a very pleasant answer. So I'm hoping it doesn't happen within 5 years.
All right, cool. All right, well, Steve, I mean, this has been awesome. We always love chatting with you. Thank you for all that you've done in this space specifically to help push it forward. There's some incredible stuff that you're working on. Please keep us updated. Love to have you back on the podcast. You know, there's some interesting segments that we're planning on bringing out, including, you know, having people that are maybe non-blockchain believers that think that there's a different answer or solution, or, you know, that it's just really a farce, right? And it really doesn't help anything. And have you go head to head with them to help educate and, you know, help people to understand both sides of the coin, right? Because there's always two sides to every story, and then there's the truth in the middle somewhere. So I'd love to have you on for that. But in the meantime, if somebody wants to follow you, keep track of everything that you're doing, where's the best place that they could follow you? Is it Twitter, LinkedIn, or email?
Twitter is probably the best place, yeah. So it's Steven Nureyov. So it's at Steven Nureyov, and that's spelled S-T-E-V-E-N, no space, second word, Nureyov, N like Nancy, Nureyoff, like Frank. I'd love to get more people involved in the crypto community. And Twitter is just a great place to get, you know, see all the different personalities and different viewpoints and debates going on and people trolling each other. You know, it's a good place. It's a little unwieldy at first. It is jumping into the deep end of the pool, but it's a great place to learn how to swim in crypto.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you again so much. Good luck with everything. And I'm sure we'll see you soon at one of these big conferences coming up here.
Thanks to both of you. Enjoy the show and looking forward to coming back.
This has been a production of Blockchain Intelligence LLC. This podcast is intended for entertainment purposes only. The thoughts and opinions of Blockchain Versus and their guests are their own and should not be construed as professional advice of any kind. Before making any investment decisions, you should always do your own research and seek help from a professional. If you would like to get in touch with the Blockchain Versus podcast, please go to www.blockchainversus.com or email us at info@blockchainversus.com.